I just want to welcome you again and let you know how excited I am for this weekend. I admit I'm one of those people. This is my first alumni event to come to. But it's just to be with such accomplished women. I was always afraid they were going to figure out they let me in by mistake, but so far I made it. And I'll just tell you one short story that I thought was funny about the advantages of being a Wahoo. I went to India some years ago as a guest of the government to work in radio there. That's what I've done. And we were landed, and we were supposed to have a day to recover and then meet the ambassador. But it turned out it was going to be on Veterans Day, and they started celebrating the holiday. So we didn't have a day to rest. We got in. We'd been on the air for, you know, basically a day and had time to take a shower and then see the ambassador. So we were kind of totally spaced out. And we walk in there, and I'm the head of the delegation, and the group is looking at me. And there's this big UVA diploma on the wall, the ambassador's. And the first thing I say is, wahoo wah. The people in my group were just like melting. But the ambassador knew exactly. We talked about some basketball, and it was great. So you never know when that's going to come in handy. But we have, there was some great information last night. I don't know, I learned a lot of new things last night. But this is the first chance for us to talk about our experience. So even though we can run over time, I've been told a little bit, but this is just so wonderful. And I, you've read the bios, I hope, of these accomplished women here. And we have some questions that we wanted to go through, but one of the things I also wanted to share with you, you probably can't see this from the back row, but the government, the Council on Women and Girls just released a study, and you've heard these statistics before. But in 1970, when I entered the University of Virginia, 8% of the women in the country had college degrees. Now it's 26%. And this has been the major advancement for women in the country is the level of educational attainment. And you may not be able to see this, but we now nearly mirror the accomplishments of men. So that barrier that was huge 40 years ago has been broken, and we contributed to that. So with that, I just want to warm up, and don't know, we'll just keep going as long as we have time for. We see this as a very informal session, so you might want to ask questions, but we're going to try and follow through with these questions. I think one of the first questions we had was, there were women here before 1970, and I want to ask you to tell us something about that, Carolyn.
Good morning. It's nice to be here this morning. My name is Carolyn Jones Duvall. I'm a graduate of the School of Nursing in 1969. So I represent the oldest person here, the graduate, on this panel today. I kind of wanted to start off with a quote from Corks and Curls, the yearbook in 1969. There's a picture showing a man holding a big poster that says, "The Gentleman's Club is dead. Long live the university." And the text beside this picture says, "The Gentleman's Club is dead indeed, but this is not all that has been lost in the transformation to a sophisticated multi-university. Much of Virginia's truly unique character, gradually shaped during its 150-year history, has also been sacrificed. Hopefully, the new university will prove in its time to be as valuable and meaningful to those who know it as the old university has been to its friends. If so, there is nothing to fear. The sacrifices will have been worthwhile, and we may join the voices that cry, long live the university." Yeah. So there was part of that, the old boys schooled here in 1969. I was really privileged to be on the Honor Committee. At that point in time, the Honor Committee was composed of the presidents of the student bodies of the schools, and I was president of the student body of the School of Nursing. I do remember having a conversation with the president of the college at the time, and he was opposed to the admission of women the following year. And I said, "Well, what's wrong with that?" And he said, "Well, Carolyn, first you're going to want women, then you're going to want cheerleaders. And then you're going to want a marching band." So we look where we ended up. But it was a great time, actually. I'm glad that people referenced last night. I know that the admission to the college started in 1970. The nursing school actually started here in 1901 and is celebrating its 110th anniversary.
Wow.
There were, and our dean's here. Our 110th anniversary, there were women in the education school. Graduate women started coming in 1920. And also there were the townies that were here. I will say that the Board of Visitors authorized the School of Nursing in 1949 to start a baccalaureate program. So we went from that hospital trained program to a four-year baccalaureate program. But the only way that program could be implemented, because women weren't here in the college, was that we had to go to another school for our first 2 years. We could either go to Mary Washington, which was the women's school of the University of Virginia at that time, that's where I went, or Longwood or Madison or somewhere else, and take our pre-nursing training and then our education and then come in here. So when people talk about groups advocating for women to be admitted to the college, the School of Nursing was really advocating. Dean Lohr and other faculty members at that time felt that this arrangement was detrimental to the nursing school. They were having great candidates go to Mary Washington and other schools, and then they never transferred in their last 2 years. So that was really something that the School of Nursing was strongly supporting. For us, when we were here, I have to tell you, a lot of our life revolved around McKim Hall. I don't know if you know where McKim is, but there was the lawn and the ranges, and on the other side of the range, across Hospital Drive, there was McKim Hall where we were housed, the School of Medicine and the hospital, and then the other faculty and the other classes were on the other side of that road. For us at McKim then, it was very different. We lived in McKim. That was our dorm. We had our nursing classes in McKim. Our nursing library was in McKim. We got our mail in McKim. So you kind of get the idea that we were on this side in McKim. Then we were attached by a colonnade to the hospital. And when we walked over the hospital, and that's where we had our clinical classes, and then also, we all ate in the hospital cafeteria because we were living and we were sleeping and we were working in that area. So for us, a lot revolved around McKim. It was a great place and we all loved it there. For those who came later, we had house mothers. We had an 8 p.m. curfew unless you signed out. And if you signed out, there were certainly more lenient hours. Our last year, we did have a key system so we could come and go as we pleased. Men could come in, but they couldn't go to the left. They could always only go to the right, and that was our reception area. Also, though, for the School of Nursing, my years that we were here, we were the first School of Nursing that took electives over in the college. So we were here 4 semesters. One of those semesters, we took a class in the Commerce School that was on management, and that was a smaller class. But 3 semesters, we did take an elective in the college, and I think we kind of paved the way for people coming. We didn't have the best selection because we had to fit whatever we were taking in between our nursing and our clinical classes. So they did tend to be the large classes, but we did participate in them. But I also don't want to represent that we were cloistered over in McKim Hall, because I don't think that was it. There's a lot of nursing students who were married to UEA grads, so that wasn't the situation then. We certainly went to football games. We went to basketball games. People were involved in activities. But there were definitely some activities that were not open to women at that time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was great. And now I'd like to ask Sandra about what it was like for her to decide to come to UVA.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Kate Brown and the other people that put this together. I think it's been great. It's been great for us, and I really appreciate being asked to be on the panel. I would like to say that I had some noble idea about coming to UVA, trying to break the gender barrier or, feeling like I had a right to be in this school. But I'm going to confess that I came here because my boyfriend was here. And the way that happened is that with UVA not having women, my being a local Charlottesville high school student at that time, we were privy to dating some guys from the campus. And so I met my husband. He came to my church, and that's where I met him, or my to-be husband. And but I had no intention of coming to UVA when I graduated because it was not open to women. I did not know that there were pending, you know, trials and that they were thinking about it. So I went to another school, Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, my freshman year. My husband, we became engaged, and my husband probably was in Nashville, and that was his senior year, and I was a freshman, and he was in Nashville about every 2 weeks, and traveling from UVA in a VW Bug. So I think that had something to do with the proposal. But at any rate, he told me that, you know, and he had a part-time job in the financial aid office. So he said, you know, they've got this program at UVA where women can be day students. And I think it's coming that they're going to, you know, open the college to women. So I really, you know, my radar had never been on UVA because it was just, you know, all male and that was it. So, I had to think about it. But the one thing that I can say about UVA is that I did know it because I lived in Charlottesville. And I actually live pretty close to the campus. I had some experiences with some students. They weren't the most ideal experiences, but my house was on Grady Avenue, and it is at the bottom of a hill that Rugby Avenue turns on. And my father had two cars parked in front of our house on Saturday nights at two different times. They were wiped out by Wahoos from Rugby Road. So I knew a little bit about the school, and wasn't sure this is what I wanted to come to. But at any rate, that was the primary reason why I came, and it turned out to be a good decision.
Thanks for that, Sandra. Cynthia, I think we discussed this question. What did you learn from overcoming obstacles, and what has this helped you for in your life?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm like Sandra. I came to UVA on the encouragement of a man who was also my boyfriend, and later my husband as well. But I guess the thing that I was struck by is the encouragement I got from men, not only in the application process, but when I arrived here. I'm really glad that the Board of Visitors was cloistered somewhere and not allowed to talk to a lot of the incoming women, because I think we all would have been running for the hills if we realized the sort of the depth of their obstinance, I guess if you could say, on the whole concept of coeducation. Because honestly, when I got here, I felt very welcome, very encouraged. My biggest obstacle was that I was a transfer student at a time where housing wasn't offered. It was, you're welcome to come, we'd love to have you attend, but we can't house you. Well, you know, that's kind of an obstacle when you think about, well, okay, how am I going to do this? I don't know anyone there other than the boyfriend. And you, as those people in this room know, you didn't move in those days. You lived in approved, you stayed in approved housing. Remember approved housing?
Yeah.
Anybody on the weekends? Yeah, with, yeah, okay. So it was one of those, and I was admitted in June to come in September. So it was really a timing issue. And I lived off grounds with three other wonderful women who were transferred from Mary Washington College of the University of Virginia. But I had some people around me, not the least of which was, again, Steve, my late husband, and Bob Canavery, who then the Dean of Students, who said, just like John Lowe did yesterday, get out. Get out. You can come do this. Get out. What do you mean you can't be involved in this? It was that kind of encouragement, I think, for a 19-year-old. Remember, we were 18 and 19 years old. I know we're all 60-ish now. But at the time, gritty, I loved that word yesterday, gritty is something I don't know that I saw in me, but others saw in me, and others obviously saw in those around me. And I think the encouragement of the men who were obviously the majority here was really profound in that obstacle. And the thing I learned from that is encouragement is all around you if you make yourself available to it. And I moved back on grounds, joined the resident staff, lived in Guathme, Mumford, met wonderful women there. Then after that, Madison House, and again, encouragement, encouragement. And then my last year, my fourth year, I was encouraged, again, by men, to apply to live on the lawn. And I got to tell you, yes, it might have been, you know, a tough starting and getting people engaged, but 2 years after the admission of women, they had somebody living on the lawn. I'm sorry, that's fast. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the bathrooms.
Perfect.
I had to ask that.
Yeah,
you know.
When I got this lawn room, obviously it was a fairly humbling experience. My mother had a fit. She had a freaking fit. She said, "What? Where do you go to the bathroom?" And I, "Where do you shower?" And I said, "Well, you go out, you put on your robe." What? You're going to be in your bathrobe and outside around? No, this was horrifying. She was a very lovely Southern woman. This was not appropriate. The university accommodated women by building, at that time, a brand new bathroom underneath the resident staff room, which is 26 on the east side. And it was fabulous. It had three big showers and four toilets and three sinks and one person, me. And it was locked. The men's room, which is across underneath my room, which was 28, was this hovel, you know, open door, low ducts, you know, in and out, lots of guys all the time. And this is my confession, your confession. I would get up, get my robe on, run downstairs, turn all three showers on, close the door, come back upstairs, brush my teeth, go back downstairs, open the door, and now it's a sauna. Yeah, it was nice.
Your secret,
nice.
I think your secret is safe. It's okay. Okay, and let's see now. One of the things, let me ask you, if you could go back, what would you do differently? Have you thought about that question?
Me?
Anne, mm-hmm. Or if you want to answer any of the previously asked questions.
I don't think there's anything at all I'd do differently. Those 4 years were incredibly happy and incredibly enriching and fun and challenging, and nothing would I do differently. Mm-hmm. You know, my decision, let me talk a little bit mm-hmm. about my decision
yes, please.
To come here. I thought I wanted to go to Duke, and so when the time came to make this decision, to apply in the first place, I'm a Southerner. I grew up in Alabama. I went to a small girls' private school. And, you know, boys from my hometown went to UVA, the very smartest boys. I mean, no one would have considered going to Harvard or Yale. UVA was the pinnacle. Mm-hmm. And so the very smartest boys that I knew growing up went to UVA. And my father was a Virginian and had been a member of the class of 1934. Now, he was not sort of an old U sort of guy. The university in the 30s was a pretty different place than it became later. And he was the son of a railroad man, and, you know, his generation was the first to go to college. And so he didn't have any sort of accreted unhappiness with the idea that the university might co-educate it. He thought it was just great, and he only had daughters anyway, so I was his last daughter and only shot. So, you know, he encouraged me, and one of the young men I knew who was in the class of 73 called me in the fall of my senior year and said, you know, they're going to take women, you know, you ought to think about applying. So I really did it with not much thought at all, as, mm-hmm. as Tootie has alluded to, about what the implications of this were. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a great school. It was one of many great Southern, my parents said, anywhere west of the, east of the Mississippi and south of the Mason-Dixon line, you can apply. And so it fit the criteria. And so when I got in, I really made the decision, I thought, mostly because I couldn't see asking my parents to pay for Duke. And Virginia, even as an out-of-state student, was a great bargain. And only later did I realize that, you know, I was a great daddy's girl, and that my father's love of this place and his introduction of it to me in the very few times, we didn't come up here a lot, but I very, very vividly remember a trip when I was about 12 years old, and we were going to Washington and by car, and I was driving, it was a trip just with my father, and we took a side trip to Charlottesville and walked around the lawn, mm-hmm. and he took me to places where that were meaningful to him, and I just thought, oh, this is heavenly, what a wonderful place. But mm-hmm. of course, it wasn't even on a possibility at the time. So when it happened, it was sort of a process where I think there were a lot of subconscious influences, but you know, I got here without a lot of pre-thought about the fact that we were the first year. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, again, I was 18 years old. Somebody told me I could be here. I'd been at a girls' school where leadership opportunities volunteering activities were totally run by women. There was no competition for those positions. You just did it if you were interested in it. And so it never occurred to me to think there might be obstacles. And I got here surrounded by wonderful classmates who were active in their high schools. I thought almost everybody but me had been a cheerleader. It was amazing how many former high school cheerleaders there were. You know, yearbook editors, student council officers, you know, everybody had done stuff. And we got here, and it was like, okay, we need to do stuff. So we just sort of fanned out and filtered into different organizations. And I think UVA has, as we all know, an extraordinary tradition of student self-governance. And that was true then, and it's true today. And because student self-governance was this huge influential principle of the way the university ran, it was a big deal to be part of everything. And now that I've had children go through high school and apply to colleges, I realize how different it is at a lot of other places. I mean, I think any place where you have an honor system, and that's pretty rare, the governing group for the honor system is a big deal, as Carolyn's experience with that, student council. But resident staff at a lot of schools is just a paid position. It is not in any way a big deal. It's not sought after. It doesn't function the way ours functioned. It wasn't considered an honor to be chosen. Guides, you know, the kids who take you on a college tour, again, they're doing it as a work study assignment. It's not something someone seeks to do as a great honor. Everything at Virginia was all about applying, getting chosen, or volunteering your time in something that was considered a very elevated, exceptional thing, because the students were running it, you know, and there were a lot more of those kinds of leadership opportunities at Virginia, partly because of the character of the place. So again, you know, most of us didn't imagine we'd ever encounter obstacles. We just went and did it, and then because we were the first, we had the opportunity to be the first at something or other if we kept at it and enjoyed it and worked hard. So I look back on those years and think, you know, I tried a lot of things. I did a great many different kinds of activities because they interested me and were available to really all of us.
Well, I was just reflecting back on some of my experiences, and I would say that overall it was wonderful. There were a couple of moments that brought me up quite short. And My name is spelled L-Y-N-N, which is also a male name. So in some ways, until they knew who I was, I could kind of fly under the radar. And I remember in the first exam in one class that I was, the professor gave out the exams in the order of the top grade on down. And the top grade, to my astonishment, was me. So when he called out Lynn Chadwick, I went up to get my paper. And he said, no, I meant Lynn Chadwick. And I said, yes. And there was this look that passed between us. And, of course, I was the only woman in the class. So the next exam comes around, and somehow I'd gotten really stupid in the week in between. And I got a C-. And I went up and got my paper, and the look happened. And then I went to the dean, and I resigned the class. I decided I was not; it wasn't worth it to fight it out with this guy. So it's funny, there were a few of these... I think we might have all bumped into a few of these that made the experience real.
You know, similar. Thing, I didn't have that great experience, but I was the only woman in most of my classes. Probably some of you had the same experience. You'd walk in, and I was one of 50 transfer students that year. There were 450 the first year, 400 first years and 50 transfer. Well, you do the math. There's not a lot of women around. And I would sit down in the classroom, and literally the seats would be left open next to me. And I don't think it's because men were resentful. It's just that they just didn't know how to cope. They're like, I don't know what this is. How do I deal with this? That was one. But also the tradition at the time was the students were called on by Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones, Mr. Anderson. They didn't.
And the professor.
They just looked at the back last name on the book and they said, Mr. Goodrich. And I answered, and they said, Miss Goodrich. And anyway, it was just those kind of moments. And you sort of had to compute them and go, okay, this is going to be a process. But I didn't have that. That's over the top.
I thought so,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
But it's prepared me in many ways for. The rest of my life, which has been... I think that's the one thing, you know, you do come out of this experience, and I feel like when I've been in that situation, which still happens now and again, I feel like, you know, look, I went through that when I was 18. Just, we're not going to go there now. Oh, good. Well, let's move along to some more fun questions here. Let's look at the time. We had some special questions for folks. Sandra. Did you have a response to your question? What did you see any special differences? Was that the question you wanted to respond to? We talked about a little earlier. What was another one?
That wasn't one of my questions.
Oh.
I can give you one experience.
Yes.
And I hope that my degree will still be good, but... but I had this... I was a major in sociology, anthropology... And I had, and some of those classes were pretty small, and there were never any women in those classes. And I had this anthropology professor that was, you know, kind of eccentric, and you know, I did fine in one of his classes, and I took another class under him, and. He called me and he said, you know, Miss Lewis, will you come by my office after the class? So I went into his office and he said, why are you taking this class, you know? So I said, well, I'm a sociology anthropology major. So he said, well, this is so similar to the one that you took before. I'll tell you what I'll do. You don't have to come to any of the classes. You write me a very nice paper, and I will give you your grade. Well, I wasn't about to turn that down. I never knew why he did it, but who knows? But I just thought later, after, you know, when you're young and things like that happen, you know, you just do it and think, oh, thank heaven. But then, you know, in later years, I've often wondered really what that was what that was all about. I mean, to be pulled out like that. But at any rate, he lived up to his promise. I didn't go to the classes, and I wrote a very good paper, and I think I got an A on it.
Well done. Your secret is safe with us. I think we can all agree to that, right? What happens in here stays. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Let's see. I had a question for Carolyn here. Who had the biggest impact on your UVA experience?
I think there are two things. One was, for me, being on the honor committee was a big deal. And it still kind of pulls at my heartstrings. It was my greatest connection with the University of Virginia and a real privilege. And that whole honesty and integrity, I know everyone, there's so much about core values and corporate and core values and everything, but honestly, it was a core value for me that I carried the rest of my life with an expectation, and I think that was one. The other thing, it's hard to step back from practicing nursing for 41 years. I just retired last year as a nurse practitioner, and when I thought back about this, I mean, the nursing professors here, they really instilled in us that it was a big deal to be a Virginia nurse. We were not just graduating to be graduate nurses, to be registered nurses. We were going to be Virginia nurses. We always heard that the University of Virginia had the highest grade, the highest percent rate on the state boards, the highest pass rate on the state boards, and that we were expected to do better every year than the year before. I also think not only collectively, but individually, our senior year of Phyllis Veronic was our class sponsor, and we had nursing research at that time at the University of Virginia that most other nursing schools didn't. It really kind of instilled an independence, learning to plan your own program, develop that, and implement that. And I think just the faculty as a whole, they instilled on us that we were going to do great things in health education, and that was an expectation. And actually, a lot of that really did pan out. So I think that was really dear, the university and particularly the nursing school.
Since you were on the honor committee, and one of the things that came up, I know when I was on campus, it was going to be the end of the honor system and the whole thing was going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. Did you see any impact about women on your experience on the honor system?
No, I think sometimes people will say, well, you were the first person on the honor committee, and that's not so. I remember the president of the student council at the School of Nursing the year before was always on. There was myself, and there was a female from the education school were the two members of, there were 11 members, and we were the two members. But I never felt that that was a detriment, or anyone felt that that was a detriment. And also, I think because I came from Mary Washington, which was the girls' or women's school of the University of Virginia, and we had the honor system at Mary Washington, too. You know, people would leave. We would take our classes and exams without proctors. So for me, it was a continuation, and I didn't have any reflection that people felt that that was going to be a detriment personally.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't see any huge honor violations from all these women walking through?
Oh, no. No, I didn't see that.
Did anyone else want to answer the question about what was the biggest influence on your life here at UVA?
You know, I mentioned him earlier, but I want to mention him again. Bob Canavery was a giant of a man, and I'm choked up even now thinking about it. He just had a way about him of really cutting through and saying, I'm all about you as a student. And it was profound. It was a profound difference. And I called on him 28 years later, when my eldest daughter was trying to decide between many fine institutions, and I called Bob, and I said, Bob, I want to send her down to Charlottesville. Could you talk to her? And honest, because she was like, I don't want to go there. It's everybody from Thomas Jefferson High School. We're from Northern Virginia, and I'm going to see everybody I know. And I was like, yeah, you take it. And he took her by the hand and walked her around the grounds, and she came home just mesmerized. Because she had made that same connection with an adult educator who said, you're the reason we exist here, not us. And I just think Bob was that He made that difference. He really did.
Well, I'm going to have to say that same thing about Bob Canterbury. And actually, not so much for myself, even though I did know him, but my husband, who came here in 1965, and there were probably about maybe five or six African-American students in the whole group, four-year group. So it wasn't a very easy time for him as well. And he met Bob Canterbury because he worked part-time in the financial aid office. And Bob, at that time, he was director of financial aid, Canterbury was. And my husband has revered Bob Canterbury, and he said, the only reason that I stayed here, I mean, there were a couple times when I was ready to pack my bags and go back home, and I went to see him. He talked to me, and he kept me here. He says there's a reason you should be here, and you got to stick it through. So I echo your thoughts.
A couple of people I'd like to mention that I have lots of great relationships with faculty and administrators who I felt were supportive not only of me as an individual but of women here in general. Irby Coffin was the dean of the college at that time. I took his classes in Shakespeare and other related topics in the English department. And because I was working for the Cavalier Daily, I had to interview him or ask him questions from time to time about articles we were writing. And Irby always took tremendous interest in how women were settling in and doing here. Ernie Earn, of course, is a key person, and by the time we finished, he'd moved from admissions into the role he had for so long as vice president for student affairs, and was extremely involved in and connected to the women and men who were involved in student activities of one sort or another. And you know, there is no greater cheerleader. I mean, he's the architect of the success of our experience, and he remained very supportive and committed. Annette Gibbs is another. Annette, early, I think many of us who came in 1970 met Annette or met with Annette at some point, and sometimes many points along the way in our first year. And Annette was, just wonderful. I mean, I felt a great connection to her. She was from Alabama originally herself, and she was so clearly here not to turn this into one of those. And I know what they're like. I saw them. My friends attended state universities in the Deep South that had been co-ed for a long time, where there were lots of rules for women, not so many rules for men, lots of, expectations and restrictions. And UVA for the men had long since gone past. There were hardly any what were called in those days parietal hours. There were no dorm mothers, and there weren't going to be any dorm mothers. There was no setup for them in the main dorms.
No hostess.
I mean, the women were placed, and I've never to this day quite known, and maybe Kevin or somebody can enlighten us as to why they chose to put the women in the Observatory Hill dorms. But you all remember, it was like the Holiday Inn. There were lots of entrances and exits. There was no lobby. There was no way to control entry. They expected us to be as mature as the men, and I'm sure we were probably more mature than many men. Annette said, I'm not coming in here to recreate Florida State, where she came from. We're going to do this the UVA way. And it was very clear in the way that was communicated to us, and lots of faculty. I mean, later on, I was privileged to be elected to the Raven Society, and the Raven president was a student, generally a graduate student, or always a graduate student, and I was elected president of the Raven Society my first year in law school. Well, the Raven Society is a faculty and student organization, and so you work very closely with faculty, and in particular, Ernest Mead, Boots Mead, who was the kind of faculty head of the Raven Society, and he was tremendously supportive of me. I was having an awful time juggling being a first-year law student and trying to plan, you know, speakers for Raven Society meetings and whatnot, and he was wonderfully encouraging and terrific to me. And I know there were elements of the faculty and certainly elements of the student body that were unhappy about coeducation, but it just didn't bubble up for me. I mean, our first week, orientation week, was when it kind of struck me that maybe I hadn't just come to just one of my several choices of schools. This was going to be different, because those dorms I described became the scene of, at night when we would sit in our suites, and the suites, of course, had a big picture window onto those hallways, the balconies, which were our hallways. And upper-class men, who I imagine were over there kind of cleaning up the fraternity houses or something, getting ready for school to start, because this was the week before classes began, and groups of them would come over to Watson, where I lived, or Webb, and walk those balconies and stare in at us, you know? it was a very strange thing, like we were in a goldfish room, you know? That's when I realized, you know, I wasn't necessarily in Kansas anymore. You know, this is a little different. But most of the men I encountered were first yearmen like myself, who'd never known any different, or second yearmen who'd been here without a car the year before. So going down the road was not nearly as cool and fun if you were a first yearman with no car. So they were all happy to have some more options socially. Mm-hmm. And so the third and fourth year guys were, we were a little more removed from them. We weren't as frequently in classes with them and so on. But there were older. Kevin was student council president. Tom Bagby was honor committee chairman. Mm-hmm. And those upper class men who were in leadership roles were very interested in the success of women and befriended a lot of us. And talk to us and in a welcoming way. I mean, I was often in either kind of activity groups, so the editor-in-chief of Cavalier Daily, Tom Adams, very, very glad that women were there and very encouraging of those of us who joined the staff. So, all of those people that I have named were incredibly impactful on my experience here and were very warm and encouraging, and they were everywhere, kind of in my personal experience.
I see, Cynthia.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted Anne to go back to before we started, Anne had some things to say about the unique time that was when we entered this university. It was a window in time that was unique in many ways, and I want you to talk about it because you were so eloquent.
Oh, well, thanks. This is my little speech about coeducation at Virginia. Any time we have an anniversary or a celebration, I say this, and I keep saying it because it seems to me more and more true over the stretch of years that have transpired since. I believe that had Virginia coeducated earlier, certainly 10 or 15 or 20 years earlier, any time really, at least from the 40s, through most of the 60s, or had it co-educated a decade or so later, I don't think the experience would have gone as smoothly. I think there was a process of change. It's this Gentleman's Club piece that Carolyn read earlier. My husband was in the class of 69, and the change he saw in the 4 years he was here in the customs of the place and the feel of the place. Coats and ties had been worn to class. I mean, they called you mister, but you were wearing a coat and tie, and that would have been tougher for women. You know, what would we have worn? There was a lot of change. The racial diversity of the school still probably isn't what we all wish it would be, but it was happening. Lim's arrival, the arrival of the fives and sixes and tens of black students, and then by the time our class was the first class entering class that was more than 10% African American, as I recall the number. So not only were there 500 women entering the university, there was a very significant increase in the number of African American students in that year and in those years around that time. And there was you know, an increase in active recruitment and of African American Virginians, particularly, to come to their capstone state university and be part of this. The Vietnam War was as big a factor as anything. You know, we got here in September, and people I ran into who were older students were not, you know, constantly talking about, wow, women are here, what's it like? They were talking about the strike. Were you here for the strike? Well, no, you know, I was at my high school prom or something. You know, no, I was here for the strike. The strike, May Days, Kent State, you know, was a much bigger impact, I think, on the feel of the place, the atmosphere of the place. It was it was like Virginia had just cracked wide open over a period of years, and we were just one more thing. And therefore, I think it was easier for us to move into life here while a lot of things were changing without being such an oddity. And I found, I mean, even by the time I finished law school, the university was shutting down a little bit. There was, I remember there was a period in the late 70s where some male student from another school had come to the university and had made a big hairy deal about the fact that the women here were peach pits. He thought they were unattractive, no fun, and this got great play in the Cavalier Daily. Anybody else remember that? The peach pit controversy? Yep. You know, and you know, America moved into the Reagan era. I mean, there, you know, I just think there was a little bit of a backlash. My personal opinion is that Edgar Shannon was tremendously supportive of coeducation. I'm not 100% convinced that Frank Hereford would have been. I mean, the atmosphere, the feel of the university changed in the moving into the end of the 70s and into the 80s. And so I think this was our perfect window of opportunity to make this work as successfully and as smoothly as it did. And obviously there were bumps. There were things that weren't perfect. But I credit the Times for some of this.
I think you're right. I know that I talk to younger women when they say, like, oh, that was such an exciting time to be on campus. It was exciting, and it was scary, and there was everything else going on. Mm-hmm. But there was a sense of community around issues that I don't think existed in later years, because everybody was so concerned about the draft or the war or the civil rights movement. Does anybody have a follow-up question on that or a follow-up thought on that? Just looking at our time, I think it'd be fun to move into the fondest memory section of this. Who wants to start? Sandra? Sandra?
I'll start. Well, I get very sentimental when I think about this. I'll give you a little background. As I told you before, I grew up in Charlottesville, and as I said before, I wasn't, you know, actively involved with a university, and obviously had no family that taught here. But my father worked at the university hospital in the pharmacy, and his grandfather worked at the university, and I think he did some groundskeeping and other things at the university. And my great-grandfather, I was told, worked at the university. And if you'll think about the timeline, my father was born in 1912. So his father was probably here as an adult in the late 1800s. And the other father was probably here in almost mid, or probably shortly after, the Civil War. So, you know, I do have that connection, and my father, you know, was aware of this, and he really loved UVA, and I mean, truly, I can say that I don't think he missed any football games. Until he just became sick, you know, as he got older. But the fondest memory I have actually is the day that I graduated. Because he was very, very tearful that day. And I just wondered, you know, why is he getting this choked up, you know? I mean, people do, but you know, it really dawned on me that how proud he was, because I imagine he thought, you know, his father would never have thought that his granddaughter would graduate from an all-male, all-white university founded by Thomas Jefferson. I mean, so I really think that was my greatest day, to see how proud and, you know, emotional my father was.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Sandra. Does anyone want to jump in at this point?
Well, Cynthia? I have a couple other great memories. Intellectually, I had some great intellectual memories. One was when I was a student here. Some of you remember Chuck Robb was in law school. And there was this fabulous speakers program my fourth year. I mean, the speakers that came through here were unbelievable, one of whom was Spiro Agnew. And I will just never forget him trying to speak and just the angst and the shouting in the amphitheater. I think it was at U-Hall, I think. I can't remember exactly. But just the fact that we had that caliber of speaker, I wish I could remember. But, you know, that was because Chuck Robb, who, of course, was Lyndon Johnson's son-in-law, who was the president of the United States at the time. So that was one great memory. Another was graduation for me as well. When we graduated, I don't know if you remember this, well, we graduated a year apart, our speaker for baccalaureate, now who remembers their baccalaureate speaker? Does anybody remember that? Okay, well, it was James Dickey, who wrote the book Deliverance.
Wow.
And how can I remember this? I mean, it was unbelievable. He spoke about the theme of the book Deliverance, which he called upthrust. And it was about seizing the moments that appear to you because they're going to be gone in an instant. That was the story about the damming up of this river. And he talked about taking this moment and seizing it because it's never going to be by again. That was a great memory. Then the silly memories. I have two great silly memories. One was eating tuna fish sandwiches in the cave. Does anybody remember the cave?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Yes. It was tragic when they closed the cave. They were the best tuna fish sandwiches. There, you know, it was underneath Old Cavill Hall, mm-hmm. and it was this perfect place in between classes before there was Starbucks. So that was just a wonderful memory that you could sit there and eat this tuna sandwich. And the other was the first time on the lawn room where I had the visitor who came and opened the door and says, "Hi, I lived here in blah, 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 blah. I'd like to meet the resident." I said, "Well, that would be me." And I mean, it was a look, yeah. Well, I mean, he was, as I recall, very nice, but stunned. So those are some great memories of this place. And the other is that the memories that live on in the relationships that were started here that still continue, the women who came together have become lifelong friends. And it was not ever the competition that I saw in my own daughters, who both went here and are both uber competitive. And not that we're not competitive, but it was a loving competition. It was an encouraging competition. It was, I got your back competition. And I think that was the continuing wonderful memory.
Thanks, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. Anne?
The friendships we made and the just fun times. I mean, living in student housing all the way through. I lived in Watson House for 3 years, first as a student and then as a resident staff member. And I have just wonderful memories of that. Charlie Whitebread was living in the suite downstairs. It was supposed to be a graduate student, and I later learned an interesting story about how he wound up there. But when he died a few years ago, actually, someone told this story at his memorial service. But he was like the Pied Piper, you know. He was just this great character and loads of fun. And all the, you know, the student friendships, most of which, you know, my very closest friends I met, you know, working on the Cavalier Daily staff together and all of that. But my men friends, too. I mean, I think the class of 74 is really special. And when I was doing alumni volunteer work and the reunion program was kind of moribund, it was something kind of happened around homecoming in a football game, and it wasn't a very big deal. And the Alumni Association had said, you know, it's time to take this on, and, you know, we're going to follow the Princeton model, and we're going to have a really big reunion program. And they kept working at it from the opposite ends, the oldest classes and the youngest classes, because there was a perception in the alumni world that classes that had finished in the late 60s and early to mid-70s were a disaffected group. That was the norm. And I kept saying, I'm telling you, 74 is different. You know, we need to have, and we didn't have a reunion until we'd been out 20 years. And we stunned the Alumni Association. Great turnout. You know, people from 74 feel a really wonderful bond with each other. And this is true of the men as it is the women, because, you know, they admired us. They enjoyed us. And their experience is very much bound up in ours. And I always remember, rush was in the fall in those days, not at the very beginning of the year, but about a month into the semester, right, roughly. And I lived, you know, in a co-ed dorm, and I'd made these great friends in the suites on the two floors below our women's floors. And the guys had all rushed, and they'd gotten bids. And what you did when you got a bid was the fraternity went down the road as a group. You know, male bonding, you got in the cars and took the beer, and you went to Sweetbriar, you went to Holland's, or you went to Mary Baldwin. And my first year, male friends went to a phone booth, and they called us from wherever they were, Holland, somewhere. And, how are you? What's going on back in Charlottesville? They were down there in this very, for them, strange environment with all these women and this peculiar place, and they were calling their buddies back in Charlottesville. And it was the sweetest moment. I thought, you know, yeah, well, we're fine. You're doing okay. You know, be careful down there. And it was really a lovely, those are some of my happy memories. And then to moving all, to fourth year. And we moved from one woman in the class of 73 on the lawn to 14. Mm. I'm glad they built that big bathroom. We needed it. Because we all had to live on East Lawn, because
yeah,
that's where it was.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And what a year. I mean, wow, it was just fabulous to be there in Mr. Jefferson's, you know, mm-hmm, central concept. My room happened to be next door to the president's office, which was in Pavilion 8 in those days, and I'd get up in my bathrobe, and Edgar Shannon would be coming to work, and I'd be going to the shower.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Hey. But, you know, and that was the year of the oil embargo. Anybody remember the oil embargo?
Mm-hmm.
And the university was having a real struggle making heat. So the lawn rooms were really cold. So we used our firewood, and Mary Bland lived next door to me, Mary Bland Love, and we shared firewood. And when exam time came around that winter, we took turns whose room would have the fire, because that person got a warm place to sleep that night. And my room still had the old floorboards. You could see daylight between the floorboards in number 36. It had never been fully renovated. It still had a door that you could tell had at one time opened in the center. It had just sort of gotten overlooked. And, man, it was cold. But, you know, it was, I wouldn't have traded that cold winter of 73 for anything. You know, it was great.
Carolyn.
Well, I think certainly the camaraderie we had in our dorm, McKim, but the fondest memory is the whole being here as a female, and that whole tie to the university. When we walked the lawn in graduation for our class of nursing, we went back and got our diplomas in the rotunda, and I just thought, we're the luckiest school here. It was just an awesome experience. And then I think when I used to come back, well, my husband could say, I always say, well, I want to go to the lawn. And it was just the tie that you had and the pride in being a female graduate of Mr. Jefferson University, and that whole, we incorporated that, and I think we love that, and that's really my fondest memory. It carries through.
Thank you for that. Does anybody have a comment or question they wanted to address to the panel, or do you have any further comments you'd like to share?
I have one, since we're talking about all this fondness.
Uh-oh.
Did we go to the same school? And no, I'm not going to say anything derogatory, because actually my experience was pleasant. It was great. I did have a lot of great classmates. But I came in actually as a day student, which is at that time, before the university officially became, the college became co-ed, there was a practice to allow staff and faculty wives to take courses in the college, and we were called day students. And that's the program my husband convinced me to come into. And so it was, and you said prior classes didn't have that, you know, feeling like you did. I graduated in 72, and I can honestly say that I didn't know any women from my class. And that is because, well, I think part of it was that I did live in Copley Hill and married student housing. So I wasn't in a dorm, and I imagine that makes a big difference. And I will correct that. I did have one lady friend that I knew because she went to high school with me. But other than that, I was thinking about when we were asked the questions, and I said, it's going to be very embarrassing to say, I don't know of any women that I knew, but there are probably only about 40 women in my entire class when I came in 69 as a day student. And there were a lot of students that you got that look from. And, you know, and they would say, how did you get here? Basically. And so, you know, some of them would say, are you in the nursing program, you know, taking an elective or something? And I said, no. I said, I'm a day student. And they still gave me this crazy look. And I said, and they said, well, what's a day student? And I really couldn't explain what a day student was to their satisfaction. But I was really, it just wasn't a very easy transition. And I might add that the very first semester in the fall when I came, my husband, who I was here for, basically, and we did get married that year, Uncle Sam called him up, and he decided to try to enlist with the local reserve unit rather than go to Vietnam, which he was successful in doing. So, but he was in basic training. So I was actually, you know, here all alone for about the whole first semester that I came. And I will say that the guys were, I really never had a guy that was rude or, you know, not friendly, and they talked to me as well. But my life was, you know, I was engaged the first part and then married. So they, you know, their life was class, and then they went back to their dorms and frat parties and that kind of thing. And I went at that time back home because I had to come back and live with my parents until my husband came back and we moved to married student housing. But I will say, and I've actually met, last night I met two women that I went to high school with who also transferred in. Now, they didn't transfer in the same year that I did. They came after me. But they were in my class, my graduating class, and we saw each other, and we all three said, I didn't know you came here. I mean, so, I mean, this was a big campus, and we were, you know, we were spread out. So it was a little, it was different for those classes before 1970. But I will say that our class, I believe, because you had to have been here at least 2 years. So the people that transferred in 1970 as juniors, they were the first women graduates in the class in 72, the very first graduates. And I'd like to, since I've talked about him so often, I'd like to point out my husband, whom I've talked about a lot, that, you know, is the reason I'm sitting on this panel. and my daughter, sitting next to him, who is a 2000 graduate of UVA. So would
Please
you all stand?
Well, I want to thank all of you. I think we could have heard a pin drop in this auditorium. People were listening so carefully to your comments, and thank you for your honesty and sharing these details. And I think it's time to wrap up and move on to our next panel to keep the show on the road. But thank you so much. And thank you so much. It's so exciting to be here with all of you.